Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal thought, to the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an olive skin from the heart of an olive tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigorous steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord.
Well, welcome to episode 82 of Agitators Anonymous. I'm Alan Averill, and you are very welcome, or at least kind of welcome, as we fast approach the 100 episodes of Season 1. Season 1 still until, as I said, the emergency is over, so it's going to be Season 1 for probably as long as my mental state holds out and I am able to do this. So, let's do it. Is it a bit of a fudge, as they say? Yes, I am from the 1950s, to ask some questions on Instagram and then make a podcast out of it. There is also a podcast I have made, which is looking back over the last 21 months, about a few of the things that I said that have or have not come true. There's a part one, which is a few episodes ago. Maybe check it out. I've put that episode on the long finger. I'm going to give it a couple more weeks because I have a feeling that the opening of society, for example, our Freedom Day that we had here in Dublin, is going to take a couple of weeks for the repercussions to sift through society before the saber-rattling ghouls of our unelected health service Stasi decide that we may move back to some form of circuit breaking restrictions, or maybe not. So let's wait and see if that happens, because that may inform some of the other things that I was talking about. And, you know, although that podcast, which I've put on the long finger, mainly discusses media behavior, media complicit behavior. That's a complicated word to say. Complicitly, is that the word? Well, whatever the word is. Coercion, you one could call it. Or the fact that once upon a time, journalists saw themselves as outside the tent, pissing in, holding power to account. But that would seem to have changed. They are now inside the tent, holding up the structures of power, pissing out on, well, let's call them the working class, because class, I think, is still one of the most important words that one can use today to describe the situation that we are in. The pajama class who are able to stay at home and work fail to understand the politics of the working class they despise so much, etc., etc. That was a heavy sentence, wasn't it? Well, that's what that podcast is particularly about. So you might going to have to wait. You maybe are going to have to wait a few weeks for that as some more dust settles, or whatever way you want to say it. So you can follow me on Nemthianga_primordial over on Instagram. We are reaching an army of 10,000, 10,000 strong. I thank you very much for following my idiocy and stupidity. Primordial has now an official Instagram page. Yes, I am aware that it took a long time to get in the game. And it was just another extra thing for me to do, to be honest. And the thought of more unpaid work, as they say, just filled me with an existential dread. But here we are. So it would be very helpful if you went over there and followed primordial_official. There's some cool old photos and old flyers. It's not slick and professional. It's not hyper based on selling you merch or anything else. There's just some curious old photos and stuff like that. Okay, go and have a look. The show is sponsored by metalblade.com. You can use the promo code AAPodcast to go over there and get 10% off. If you were in North America, you need that new Cannibal Corpse album, don't you? Yeah, you know you do. Right. And Eisenwald Records, post-black metal, pagan metal, whatever you want to call it, www.eisenton.de in Europe and .com. In North America. Go over there and use the promo code AAPodcast and you can get free shipping. Go and take a look at some of the cool bands they have, because they do actually have a lot of cool bands. Right then. So what I did was I put out a few questions on the gram, the Instagram, and said, you know, let's maybe make the next podcast or two a little bit of a Q&A or something that can spike my grey matter. Could it be that I just felt a little bit uninspired and was just busy staring out the window at the rather heavy monsoon winter Irish rain that was teeming down and thought, God damn it, what am I going to do my podcast about? Of course, I'm recording this before tomorrow's podcast with H.P. Lovecraft dropped, so I'm interested to see what the reaction will be to that. It's not really a discussion or... what am I talking about? I'm telling you what it will be after you may have listened to it. Right. Okay. Break your brain around that, etc. Come on, Avril. Sort yourself out and get your timeline correct. Yes. Well, I guess I'll see in the comments and the observations what you all thought of the H.P. Lovecraft podcast. I'm going to do more of those where I get a bit more into characters from history. It's something that I guess, neglected to do, but there you go, H.P. Lovecraft. So, let me put my reading glasses on and examine the questions from Instagram. Like I said, this is a bit of a Q&A podcast, and some of the questions are pretty serious, and we'll get serious answers, and some are not. So, if you hear your name, well, cheers for answering the call and asking me a question. Thank you for your patronage or whatever it is they say in the 16th century. Han from Anti-Life, the curious name. Do you plan some other collaborations like with The Nest at this year's Roadburn? The plan of the collaboration with The Nest was really The Nest's plan, not exactly mine. That came from the tour Dread Sovereign did with Saturnalia Temple and obviously Wolven Nest. Where we opened that tour and became good friends with all of those people. Of course, we knew Saturnalia Temple from before. But Wolven Nest, I suppose there's a kind of pragmatism to their involvement in this year's Roadburn. And that was, of course, that they're from the country next to Roadburn. And seeing as Tommy from Saturnalia Temple and myself were the only people to fly in to take part, as I understood, in this year's Roadburn. In fact, we travelled further than anyone to take part in this year's Roadburn, to support Roadburn. It was a pragmatic decision, I think, on behalf of the band and the festival to have bands from the lowlands areas or surrounding areas who didn't have to travel too far in the middle of a global emergency, of a pandemic-y situation, etc. So they, of course, played on the Sunday and Wolven Nest played on the Saturday. Now, I did a podcast about the experience of travelling and taking part in that. And the truth is that I suppose every month someone somewhere asks me to sing on something or take part in something, or would you lend your vocals to this? I suppose that's what happens when you are a clean singer, I suppose, in the sense in that you're using clean vocals in a scene, or have come from a scene that is predominantly, as you say, black metal or harsh vocals. And I'm not going to say whether that's I'm not going to comment on the on the strength of those vocals or not. But what happens is that because you have, you become quite marked out, people write songs and they go, ah, oh, I wonder if that voice would fit on this, and you seem to fit that mold. So I end up getting asked an awful lot by people to take part in things. And so every month or two, whether it's, I suppose, some demo band who ask me, or friends who ask me, and of course in the past I've done vocals with Marduk, I've done most recently Me and That Man and Rome, and those are collaborations that I suppose were created by other people, and then I was asked to take part. As for me writing the music and asking other people to take part, I suppose you could look at Dread Sovereign a little bit like that. I suppose we could look at the electronic project I did with my cousin. Even that was a sort of mutual creation or something like that. But I think it's very important as a musician to try and stretch yourself, to try and work with other people, to be challenged by other people's ideas. For example, in April Men, the vocals, if you haven't checked it out, go and check out. Just put in April Men. For example, when singing in that, you aren't singing against a wall of guitar. So the dynamic range in that music is so completely, it's so completely different. And so it has an awful lot of other textures and dynamics you have to try and employ with the voice. Same with Me and That Man, and same with Rome. You find yourself singing over much quieter music, essentially, I suppose, because it's acoustic or electronic. And that's a whole different set of skills to try and learn, because you're used to kind of bellowing sometimes in the Dickinson 83 mold, because you have to be heard over a wall of frequencies, and so therefore it changes the game a bit. But I am always planning something, I'm always plotting something. I think it's very important to not stand still, to always keep moving, to keep doing something else, as long as you have the energy and the I suppose the level is high. I don't really want to take part in something that's just sort of half-hearted and go, here's a verse of a vocal. You have to sort of put everything into it. But I also don't want to be the guy who appears on every other record every time there's a clean vocal. So it's a rather difficult line to walk sometimes, to know which to take part in or not to take part in. But certainly the collaboration with Wolvenest was something that it was entirely self-evident as soon as I was asked, and as soon as I heard the song that was written with my singing in mind, I went, yep, of course, no, I'm in with this. And then, of course, I talked to Tommy from Saturnalia Temple, who you should all go and check out, by the way. And I said, man, we have to travel to this. We have to make a point about going, a bit of a statement. And so that's how the whole thing took shape. And then you rehearse in Belgium. And what a feeling that was after a year off, or a year and a more off, which felt like 10 years, to be back in a room with creative people. And that's really what you want to do. I suppose the moment where you step out from being a hobbyist to a musician is a very important internal decision-making process, where you decide one day, you know what, I'm a musician, and that's what I'm going to put when I fill in those silly forms when I enter one country into the next, and I go, and it says profession, which once upon a time I would have been I don't know, shit talker, hobbyist, pirate, whatever you want, vagrant, whatever. Now I put musician. Okay, it can be a poorly paid profession, of course, but a profession nonetheless. So there's always something happening, and I always have some kind of plan for something in the back of my head. Somewhere is a plan to make a kind of really stripped down, acoustic-y sort of vocal-based record, but which I might try and record at some stage next year. Who knows? I don't know if the world really needs that. I know that many people said, oh, the pandemic is going to inspire lots of people to make lots more music. And I thought, is that really a good thing when you pick up a metal magazine and you see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of releases every month and there doesn't seem to be any slowing of the process? I thought maybe it's a better time to take stock, to take a bit of reflection on what music you were making, rather than every metal musician churning out a neo-folk album and an Americana album, and here's my this album and here's my that album. I don't know. But I understand the need, the will, the necessity to keep moving. So you're walking some kind of creative tightrope, I think. But as long as you have energy to do it, I think that, why not? It's a short spin around this mortal coil, as they say, before you shuffle off this earth. So why not try and leave as much of a creative mark as you can, is my sort of my sort of idea about how to approach all of it. Grind Your Mind 77. Grind or Grindy Our Mind, maybe. Which is it? Any chance of other members on for a chat? I fully understand it's not the primordial podcast. Well, this is something that I did allude to briefly when I was discussing, the band stepping down from Steelfest, for example. I briefly alluded to it. We agreed that there was no statement. The band did not discuss it, etc. And people were a bit nonplussed. And the truth is that band decisions are a democracy of five people, which take into account all of those five decisions. Agitators Anonymous is my podcast. It's my waffling, it's my talking, it's my debating. It's not the primordial podcast, and there must be a separation between those two things. It's not the mouthpiece or the sort of COVID promo for primordial. It's not the thing that I do to keep the band in the spotlight, if that can really be the word for it, during the pandemic or whatever you want to call it. It's a personal necessity, I guess. It's a way of me personally exercising my demons or dealing with ideas or putting out, just putting out thoughts into the ether for all the people who deem it worthy of listening to or whatever you want to call it. There is a division, and that division is Agitators Anonymous is me. And it is not the primordial podcast. So as long as you make that division in your mind and don't hold primordial personally responsible for maybe a view that I hold that you think to yourself, I disagree with that. As you may find, there are some that you disagree with in the fullness of this podcast. Make the division that I don't speak for primordial, nor have I ever said that I was during this podcast. So, that's an important division. And I think that that's a good prompt question to answer that fundamentally. That if the band decides, no, that's not ours to discuss, well, then I don't, discuss it on their behalf, so to speak, even though it may seem that I am doing that right now. Any chance of the other members on for a chat? I mean, there is and there isn't. If you've ever seen video interviews, and they are rare with the other members of Primordial, it's not really their thing. They aren't really into that. Kieran does a few. Maybe I can get him on sometime. But, people are busy. They have different responsibilities in life. I just happen to be a fancy Dan man of leisure who has the time to answer your questions on the Instagram. Whereas Kieran, as a hard-working chap, doesn't. But maybe. It would make sense that now, this year being the 30th anniversary of the band, since we started out as wee baby teenagers with baby faces full of hopes and dreams. That's a strange sentence, isn't it? That I should get some of them on. But, trying to organise that can be greeted with a shrug of the shoulders. And why not? Because there are other things to be doing with your life. Who would play you in Nemthienga the movie from Dark Side Dublin? There's a smart arse of a question. Who would play me? I've always fancied myself as a bit of a thespian. Maybe it's not too late for me to do it, is it? I mean, am I that far removed from my teenage years? Who would play me in Nemthienga the movie? Can I pick someone from history? I'd like an Oliver Reed or a Richard Burton or something. One of those burly old back of the hand to nonsense kind of actors from the 1950s, 60s or 70s. That would be my choice. A hard drinking, womanizing, sex, drugs and rock and rolling kind of thespian who's also able to handle the roles of the Shakespeares and Hamlets while also drinking 30 pints of lager and showing the back of his hand to all those who disagree with him. Blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Can I pick Richard Burton? I think he'd be perfect. Or I suppose any ginger actor from the 1980s who disappeared out of view. There was quite a few ginger actors in the 80s, wasn't there? But they kind of disappeared off the radar, didn't they, really? They're not in vogue anymore. So seeing as I feel part of a victimized class, the gingers, I would like to see some sort of up-and-coming famous young ginger take the role on of my life So I suppose in theory that would have to be one of the Gleesons, wouldn't it? There seems to be about three Gleeson brothers who all seem to be condemned with the ginger gene, who are acting across Hollywood every time Hollywood needs an anemic looking young ginger pale faced Irish or Celtic face. They appropriate one of the Gleesons. So one of them, yeah. By the way, very funny. All right, Andy from Sayre. Hello, Andy from Sayre. How are you? How long do you see yourself continuing as a musician? Does the current situation change anything? That's a very good question. I think, you know, when you're 16, when you start the band, the initial idea was that we would just make a demo and make an album. And you were looking at bands like Rotting Christ or Varathron or Beherit or whatever it was, and you're going, oh God, it would be amazing to make a record like those bands. You didn't think in terms of a career. And then as that rolled on into your 20s and into your 30s, about 15 years in, you realize, oh, this is kind of like a career. Okay, not a career as in how your parents would define having a career, as in something that's going to buy you a house or make you a living. But you don't really think about it when you're in the middle of it. Like, you know, you're kind of in that bubble of being within a band. And then it becomes something that you've been in longer than you haven't. So, you know, Primordial is something that I've been in 2/3 of my life. So it eclipsed the halfway mark several years ago. And you realize that standing on a stage or being creative is something you're probably always going to have within you. But do I see myself pulling on the leathers and putting on the corpse paint when I'm 55? It's really hard to say. I mean, if there is somebody there, if there is a crowd for it, if there are people who want to see it, then it's possible. I don't see any reason why you can't be a fit and healthy 55-year-old who's still able to sing these songs and still able to put life and energy into them, although that may not be the case. Or you might quite get to 50 and go, okay, well, that's it. We got to 30 plus years, you know, and it quietly shuffles off. It shuffles off I'm not sure how to say it, really. It just ceases to be slowly but surely. And you go down from playing 20, 30 shows a year to 5, to 2, to 3, to 1. And maybe you play the odd Reformation. I don't know how it goes. It's probably a better question to ask somebody in their mid-50s. But you look at bands like Destruction and Creator and all those kind of guys who are in their mid-50s, and they don't see any sign of slowing. I suppose what it is that once you've been bitten by that bug of being on stage and touring, and that's all you kind of know. Not to say that it's the only thing that we know, but it adds this other extra dimension to your life that makes it, as you very well know, being in Sayre, worth living. It's an outlet for your creativity, but it's also an outlet for your aggression, your frustration, the mundanities of life, and deciding that is enough is enough is a quite a big decision. Now, of course, that decision can be made by life itself. It can be made because of health, because of illness, because of kids' responsibilities, or you just get sick of it. You know, I spoke yesterday on Instagram with Nicholas Sundin, who I used to write with from Dark Tranquillity, and he just said he just didn't like touring anymore. And there are many people who get to that place where they just go, I don't really want to sit in a van anymore. I don't want to sit in airports anymore. I don't want to run on no sleep every weekend. For me, I love that. But other people are made differently. So maybe it's not up to me how long the band goes. Maybe one of the other members goes, you know what? We've had a very long run of it. Let's look back on what we've done and be proud of it and start to wind it down. But creatively, it's still in you. And also the thing is, especially for the metal underground, when you've been part of the underground since you were a young teenager, starting the band at 15, 16, 17, 30 years means you're still quite a few years. Most of us are in our mid-40s, mid to, you know, 44, 45, 46, 47. So we're not really that old. So the idea that there could be 10 more years in it doesn't seem that crazy, to be honest with you, Andy. Does the current situation change anything? Well, I mean, I said it often during the pandemic that if rules and restrictions were to stay in place and the band was not able to gig and travel, I would see, I wouldn't see as much point in making heavy metal, because heavy metal, that's where heavy metal lives, to be honest. It doesn't live with me on a, you know, at the end of a screen, on a square, on a screen, making music remotely, people tuning into stream concerts from my living room. That's not heavy metal, and that's not why I got into a band. We get into bands to be in rooms with other people. As we know, Andy, from playing together in London recently, the communion between the band and audience, the atmosphere in the backstage, the camaraderie, the banter, the whatever else you want to call it, that thing is essential. Even just the tour last week with Winterfillet and Dread Sovereign, people on that tour I'd not met before, the sound girl Hannah, for example, and you spend more time in that week together than you do with an awful lot of your friends in a normal year, or even some members of your, you know, peripheral members of your family. And so you become fast friends. You rely on each other to solve problems. You rely on each other for lots of things. There are many, many sort of intimate gestures within a tour framework. The other guys in Dread Sovereign who may not have known Winterfellow guys, or you don't know somebody on a tour and you make fast friends. And you know that that moment where maybe you give them a call when you're in the city and go, hey, man, I'm in trouble, whatever. You know, where sometimes I get a call from one of the Niflheim brothers going, Blaze Bailey is in town, can we stay on your floor? And I go, sorry, Eric. And I go, yeah, of course. That's rather a Niflheim-y example, but you understand. Those are bonds that, you know, you can reap, you can pick up from a band that you haven't seen for 10 or 15 or 20 years and go, because you spent so much time with them. I mean, it may sound odd, but from Twilight of the Gods to Primordial, we spent a lot of time with bands you couldn't imagine we did, like Corpic Clanny. For example, we spent probably a month or two in the company of those guys. So you get to know people, you know? And I think that that's a very important human process that's deep within, you know, the making music or being in a band. The current situation changed. I mean, I railed against it and was frustrated and angry at the idea that I thought, and I still do believe, that draconian authoritarian measures were putting art, creativity, culture, and everything like that in that realm was put to the sword first. It was just viewed as dispensable. And I think that musicians and artists clearly saw how little they were viewed or worth as their sector remained, still remains, kind of unopened in this country. And it was seen as an expensive moral and cultural luxury. When, of course, the reality is that artists should define moments of culture and history. But, however, that's a discussion that's probably on a different podcast. But in the fullness of the time of the emergency, I think it was that moment for quite a lot of musicians to maybe take stock of the things they've done. And certainly beneath the anger and frustration was where there were a lot of moments where you had to, you know, I picked up all some of the records that I'd made, looked over the lyrics, you know, even listened to some of them, which is not something you do that often. Surprisingly, I don't really listen to the records that I've done, and I thought, wow, what a great canon of work we've made. What a great body of work to be proud of. And that was a great feeling. And so the situation caused a pause, which was a moment of reflection, an important moment of reflection, even if it wasn't needed or wanted, at least not from my behalf, because if somebody had said to me, hey, you have a year or two off and you can take a backpack and go around South America and turn off your social media, brilliant. I would have known. And then you go, OK, it comes back on this date. But of course, the nature of this new papers, please, restricted and ruled society that we've created, whereby what was clearly once unprecedented, as in lockdown, is now precedented, i.e. it has precedence, and I think will be used again and again. I mean, it remains to be seen whether I'm wrong about that, but art and music will be the first thing. Art, music, entertainment, whatever else, will be the first sector that just gets constantly cut every time there is a sign or, you know, arbitrary health and safety rules decide that this needs to be, you know, hit on the head and knocked out. We will be the first every time to go. And I think that that precedence has been set. So if it was to keep being reset to the point where Primordial couldn't leave Ireland, couldn't fly, I mean, wait for the climate lockdown, to put paid to our plans for touring and festivals, we'll see how much of a saber rattle that one is. It's a complicated question, Andy. I think that as creative people, I think you always generally have to be creative. Maybe it moves into different forms. Maybe you start to write. Maybe you start to make, as I said, acoustic music for a smaller audience. Maybe you want to paint. Maybe there's lots of other things. But I think once it's within you, I think it's very hard to make peace with not having an outlet for that. But it remains to be seen, Andy. But sure, aren't we young bucks yet, huh? Well, indeed. Kveldulv. Kveldulv. What does that mean? Dark bird, dark raven, Kveldulv, black something? I don't know. What is your thoughts on making a concept album with Primordial? Well, some of the Primordial albums do have rough concepts. Seeing as Redemption is 10 years old, let's talk about that. There is a rough concept to Redemption, which is about the structures of faith and religion and how we deal with them, about how we deal with the idea that you might just be a cage of flesh and blood on a rock hurtling through infinite space by chance, and the true despair of that understanding is such an existential crisis out of which we have created religions, deities. We've moved from zoomorphic ideals to, I suppose, the sort of singular God theory that we have now, the omnipresent creator, the primogenitor, whatever you want to call it. All of these myths, folklore and mythologies that we've created over the thousands of years to try and make sense of that stark reality that we could just be here purely by chance hurtling on a rock through space. And that, wow, how did I get there so quick? The point being that Redemption, for example, is a rough concept album about religion, about faith, about dealing with the structures of mortality, about how we deal with the fact that we have to shuffle off this mortal coil and what will remain of us, etc. So, there are rough concept albums. If you mean an Operation style mind crime or an Operation Mind Crime style concept album, then I'm not sure about that. That requires the idea of, it's one thing you'll notice within Primordial. There's very few first person narratives. I don't create characters that speak to each other. For example, you can find this in King Diamond, Them or something, but more beautifully and poetically, you'll find it in Nick Cave or Leonard Cohen or Tom Waits, for example. The idea that in 3 or 4 minutes, they've created a character, a scenario, a setting, a conversation. This is a very, very remote skill. And I think it's one of the hardest skills to replicate, especially in metal where the music is so kind of dynamic and loud and noisy. Often to try and recreate a conversation between characters in a story framework within the movement is something I very rarely touched. And I think it's a skill I probably don't have, which is what makes, for example, if you take Red Right Hand or something like, take a Nick Cave lyric and look at how he explores in 4 or 5 or 6 minutes the relationship between two characters, and you're in the story. You're right in there, and he takes you right in from the first few lines. This is a very, very difficult skill, I think, as a lyric writer. And I don't know if there's any real metal bands who've really tried to handle that. And so I'm not sure if I could, in Queensryche, you have some of the characters speak to each other, Crimson Idol, maybe. I don't think they're artistically on the same level as a Nick Cave, for example, or Leonard Cohen. But you can see that, for example, I mean, it's the benchmark by which most concept albums are made, Operation Mindcrime, that it is so intelligently put together and that the different characters speak to each other. So, it's a very big undertaking, that, and you want to be completely prepared and organized and have a very, very rehearsed and tight concept, which generally isn't really Primordial. We're not really the most over rehearsed band who have everything worked out to a T. That's sort of not the Irish style, not really our style. So there's loose concepts. There is loose concepts. You just sort of have to try and follow the train, or the sort of, we say, the line of thought running through them. So yes and no. S. Ragnarsson. Maybe let's speak about science fiction. Yeah, science fiction, of course. Old movies and books. I must admit, and I'll say it sort of straight out, I'm not a movie buff. I'm not a movie person. I am and I am not, in that I enjoy going to the movies, and I have some, you know, things that I liked. I mean, if you know, asked me when my 20s, I would have said, oh, Jim Jarmusch is my favorite director and I like this movie and that movie. But I'm not a movie guy. I have friends who would sit and watch the same movie 4, 5, 6 times. It's what they want to put on at parties and sit and drink beer and quote the dialogue. This is not me. If that's going to happen, I'll ruin it party by speaking over it or whatever. It's not my... music is my thing. Not so much movies, really. I mean, obviously, I play in a band, Metal Salvage, with some of the Gamma Bomb lads. And knowing all of those guys, they seem to be able to speak to each other in the dialogue of B and C movies from the 1980s that I actually have never even heard. Or never even heard. See if I've done it there. Sorry, Freud. I've never even seen. Even though they were out when I was a teenager. I'm standing there listening to go, what are you guys talking about? And they're going, oh, it's dialogue from Romancing the Stone or Big Trouble in Little China. For example, I don't know. I've never seen those movies. They're just not part of my childhood, I suppose, which seemed to have been much more about reading books. So when it comes to all science fiction, of course, we're only just discussing Dune. Frank Herbert went to see the movie of Dune, which I thought was sort of horribly simplistic. Dialogue written for 13-year-olds, horrible simpering teenage actors, and a sort of very predictably sort of odd woke ethic to it, which maybe wasn't supposed to be there, I don't know, and I read into it. Maybe not, maybe I was just a bit cranky that day, which is also possible. It looked amazing, I'll give it that. But missed a bit of the sort of crazy steampunk idealism of the original Dune, which I remember reading as a teenager. It's also ditched some of the complexities. And is there still a screenwriter strike at Hollywood? What happened to that? That was talked about so many years ago. Because for sure, every big movie I see these days has dreadful dialogue, and it would seem dreadful acting. But do they choose actors now based on how big their Instagram reach is? Because that's a handy promotional tool. I mean, that is something that happens throughout the rest of the entertainment or creative industry. I mean, bands are signed if they have 100,000. I mean, a band who has a, let's call it, an influencer within their ranks through maybe for some other things, maybe it's through keeping fit or whatever else. If you have a band who've sold no records and they have one guy or one girl in the band who has 100,000 followers on Instagram, you'll be signed. Because that's a ready-made promotional tool of 100,000 followers. So is it the same in movies? I don't know. Does the simpering, annoying guy who acts as the main character in Dune, who I don't know the name of, who seems to be in everything, who clearly can't act, does he have 4 million followers? Is that how? Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, who cares? I don't know. But yeah, I'm not a movie guy. But when we talk about books, then yeah, of course, you know, I mean, your Isaac Asimov's, Robert Heinlein, Frank Herbert, Philip K. Dick, of course, all of these books. Thankfully, I'm quite thankful to my father for having a huge library of these small science fiction novellas, or whatever you want to call them, like, you know, 100 to 200 pages. And I must have read over 100 of them easily when I was a teenager. All the Philip K. Dicks, everything just ran through his entire library. And that's what that had a deeper resonance for me when I was a kid than the movies, I guess. So maybe I should do a podcast about old science fiction. Yeah, it's a good point, Mr. Ragnarsson, son of Ragnar. Neil Avalon. Can you see festivals going ahead next year, given health experts advise that vaccines wane over time? Well, this will be the last question for part one of this Instagram question podcast, I guess. And it's a pretty big question. It's something I've addressed in previous podcasts. It's a very complicated question. Really, really it is. It's and it's got so many levels to it. I can see open-air festivals being more likely to take place than indoor festivals, if the vaccination leverage, if the fear-mongering is ramped up about new variants of this, that, and the other, etc. You know, look, by now, if you've been listening to the podcast, you'll know my views on, you know, what's happened about a lot of things and this sort of if it bleeds, it leads idea that the mainstream media have been pushing a certain narrative to keep people afraid, blah, 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 amongst other things. But the idea that indoor entertainment, as I said, like 15 minutes ago, or indoor art or whatever you want to call it, those spaces where people are social with each other will be the first to be cut every time there is some reason for state, tech, pharma to decide that that is so. They will be the first things to go every time. And so the idea that a new variant could cancel indoor live music again next month, March, you know, January, February, March, April, is quite possible because, of course, you've got flu season, you've got a whole different raft of worries within that winter illness season. It's very possible. Open air next summer, of course, is a different set of rules because, well, it's open air. And even the WHO have said that outside transmissibility is almost negligible. Hence why the reality of seeing people walking around the streets of Ireland in lashing rain and wind with their masks on at midnight. It just doesn't make any sense, really, does it? That's a different argument, though. But outside transmissibility, etc., I think outdoor festivals are probably more likely to happen fundamentally, even though they have more people, because I suppose it's just the optics of it, people being outside. I also think, to be honest, Neil, it's going to depend from country to country. We've seen clearly that a Europe-wide response to what's happening has been a bit of a joke, that every country is moving at different speeds, different arbitrary rules, different restrictions. There's different people in charge who have different agendas. Some are more in hock to Big Pharma than others, it would seem. Some are more delighted to impose authoritarian ideals and structures. I'm looking at you, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, Scotland, etc. Some aren't. I'm looking at you, Eastern Europe, who know what authoritarianism is quite clearly because they have had it in living memory. And the people there are not going to put up with the same things that seem to fly in Anglosphere, shall we say, slightly pampered countries that have a broader middle class acquiescence to such things. But that's, of course, a different question. I know you got to use the word acquiescence. Maybe I used it in the wrong context there. But given health experts' advice, I mean, yeah, vaccines wane over time. I mean, again, this is the thing, is this the reality is that whatever way you view the virus or vaccines or anything, these kind of things, it's going to be have to be something that society lives with or learns to live with or just accepts that this is part of life and that it's endemic, I think is the phrase, and that it's just something that we have. I mean, 20 to 40,000 people, I think, in the UK, I think, died of flu every year naturally or normally anyway. So and die from many, many other things. There's an envelope of death, whatever it is, you know, several millions every year on the earth, and that doesn't change. So living with that, but then again, that requires a certain dismantling of the structures that we've put in place around it. And I'm not so sure, as I said, that state tech and pharma are willing to give up what has seen in the last 21 or 22 months the greatest transfer of wealth and power realistically in the history of mankind, if I'm not too well, that's a rather over the top statement, but certainly a massive transfer of wealth and power has accrued. And why would the people who are at the receiving end of that wish it to stop? Certainly not so you can have a gig or two, right? That's my cynical opinion. And that was my cynical opinion from day one, and which has been sort of borne out by the situation that we are in, I would say, to a greater percentage. Of course, there's some things that I, you know, overshot the mark with my pessimism. But do we just enter a cycle like you can see in Israel now where they're going boosters, 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 jabs? I mean, realistically, it's a health tax created on the world that can be, I suppose, theoretically enforced at any time and will. So, Neil Avalon, the answer is very complicated. Very, very complicated. it remains to be seen whether this just fades into the rearview mirror and people are allowed to continue on with their everyday lives, with the normal lives they had before, with their civil liberties, freedoms, that are their inalienable right, i.e., as you say, the pursuit of art, creativity, travel, the I suppose the economies of life itself, etc., etc., etc. Complicated, Neil. Complicated. Could all be knocked on the head. And there are, I don't think there's anything really the arts or musician sector can really do about it. We've seen quite easily that we're dispensable. Anyway. Complicated. Complicated. And lastly, but very much leastly, Eva in the Horrors. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's a track on Mortgage? Well, as I understand it, a track on Mortgage is a home loan one would get or one got where your interest rate is linked to the to what's happening in the rest of Europe, the European Central Bank rate of interest. And it has a sort of margin on either side for the bank that issued it. And so therefore the borrowers get... how can I explain the benefit of rates that are typically low if that's what's low in the rest of Europe? I don't really know how this affects your decision making in Ireland, because it would seem that our interest rates for loans, for home loans, were exorbitant and almost reached 100% during the boom, didn't they? How that affects a tracker mortgage, I don't know. Ha ha ha, funny question. There's your answer. It's a mortgage loan that's fixed to the European, I don't know what you would call it, the mean average rate of loans. I don't know how that affects your rate within your own home country or your own European member state. And I have no clue, because I am one of those people who will never, ever be able to afford a house. And neither should you. Besides which, aren't all your houses now owned by Chinese investment firms? Indeed. Right. That's been Agitators Anonymous. It's a strange ramble across a bunch of different questions. There will be a part two of this, because there's a whole bunch of other great questions that I have to answer, such as, am I a secret Marxist? And so, hold on to your seats. Hold on to your hats for that answer in the next episode, my friends. Agitators Anonymous. Follow me on the Instagram, nemtheang_primordial, etc., etc., etc. Over and out.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.